other friends entailed was its own form of therapy. Raquel Diaz firmly believed that going crazy was a luxury of the wealthy, because poor people like her had too many responsibilities to bother with mental health episodes. Though her consciousness was frayed just as Oswaldo's was, she didn't permit herself to seek help. Her grades remained stellar, but her mother couldn't afford the tuition anymore. Her classmates seemed to find new and original ways to enrage her, and her boyfriend of 2 years had had his own psychotic break, and had recently been stalking other women and trying to become a rapper. So she took her junior year off to work as an au pair in Italy and then visit China, an opportunity that the college master helped her secure. The hiatus from school was intended to salvage her brain, reassemble her finances, and place some much-needed distance between herself and this campus, to regain a level of perspective that would see her through graduation. Her friends and roommates let her know that this was a short-sighted decision that would delay her life by a full year, remove her from close friendships, and waste so much of the work she'd already put in. When Rob showed up, she was filled with self-doubt and overwhelmed with the task of packing up her room at the end of sophomore year. They spent a full day organizing her possessions, with Rob lugging her furniture down to the basement storage rooms. Throughout, he told her not to worry about what anyone else was telling her, not to worry about anything at all except getting herself right. "You know what you have to do," he said more than once that day. And she did, knowing that while she was gone, Rob would continue doing what he had to do, not only in terms of dealing and consuming marijuana, but also by carrying whatever burdens he had to carry alone, and walking with order and strength, and striving to help those around him do the same. At the end of junior year, Rob began receiving cryptic emails from phony Hotmail accounts. "We are watching you. We know where you are, and we are coming. Be prepared. Tonight is the night when it will happen." Rob wasn't alarmed, paranoid, or impelled to think that he needed to start watching his back again. In fact, he was amused, because the emails meant that he was being tapped for a secret society initiation. The most famous society was Skull and Bones, referenced in the biographies of both Bush presidents and movies both Highbrow, The Good Shepherd, and Lowbrow, The Skulls. There were many other societies, Wolf's Head, Squirrel and Key, Mason Chain, Book and Snake, Berzelius, and on and on. Each was composed of 12 seniors chosen by the class preceding them. The oldest societies occupied heavily gated, windowless, sepulchre-like buildings dotting the campus. Being tapped for any society, particularly the older, more secretive ones, was considered an exclusive honor, like a badge that said you had made an impression on this campus during the previous 3 years. Admission was quietly coveted by many. I, for one, was surprised when Rob went ahead with the initiation for the group that had chosen him, Elihu, named after the university's founder, Elihu Yale. A secret society was, in essence, yet another version of the manufactured friendships that Yale was, in Rob's view, constantly foisting upon its students. My roommate had always felt, loudly at times, that he had had his real friends and didn't have time for facsimiles of friendships. As such, he was not primed to give a shit about another construct asking for his time. Maybe he was curious. Maybe, in a pragmatic way, he was thinking ahead to the future career contacts such an association promised. Maybe he had become more of a Yaley than he'd ever admit. Initiation was protracted over 3 weeks in the spring. The specifics varied from society to society, but they typically involved seniors wearing masks and dark robes walking across campus like so many grim reapers to perform minor hazing rituals that took place in various chapels, with an almost celebratory emphasis on the cultishness of it all. Like learning the school songs at St. Benedict's, Rob had to memorize verses written on papyrus scrolls that detailed the history of Elihu, the school's third oldest secret society. He had no trouble doing this, mumbling the words with an exaggerated detachment from the proceedings, a contrast to peers who did the same thing with trembling, anxious, humbled whispers. Then came tap night, when the campus erupted with a few hundred inebriated students assigned tasks for the night, breaking into classroom buildings to steal chairs, climbing campus monuments to sing songs in their underwear, etc. Rob was asked to lie on his stomach in front of the library and to challenge any passing campus police to an arm wrestling match. "Nah," he said. He'd grown up in a neighborhood in which policemen were constantly checking him out, and in which policemen, in his eyes, had set up his father for life in prison. You can't get me to do that. In the end, they couldn't. The following week, he and the 11 other new members of Elihu were invited to the society-owned property, a federal-style house on the New Haven Green, to drink and receive their pins with hoods and masks removed. Every Thursday and Sunday night throughout senior year, this group would meet here for a few hours, the goal to open up fully to people who otherwise would have remained merely acquaintances or strangers, to actualize, in a way, the Yale experience in which so many different people of so many different backgrounds were tapped to live in these cordoned-off city blocks together. Rob seemed more interested in the fact that he would now have access to the house, which, through generous alumni contributions, had its own housekeeping service and was kept fully stocked with high-end food and booze year-round. The newly tapped members each owed $100 to the treasurer, Laurel Bachner, a Manhattanite from the Upper East Side and a Dalton School alum. Rob's check bounced initially, and he seemed to forget about it after that. She was nervous about confronting him. An inherent discomfort existed between a rich white girl approaching a poor black man regarding money he owed. She'd never known anyone in her life who couldn't keep $100 in the bank. He'd already made a few cracks about her spoiled upbringing, and she was prepared to cover his dues herself to spare them both the confrontation. Just before she did so, Rob stopped her on campus and slipped her the money in cash. "Sorry about that," he said. "The bank changed my account number for some reason. That's why the check bounced." The Elihu retreat at the end of that year took place at the New York Governor's Mansion in Albany. A senior member of Elihu was the governor's daughter. Oswaldo, recently out of the psychiatric ward, and doing his best to catch up on his classes before year's end, still took a moment to pull Rob aside. "Don't be a fool," was his advice, meaning, "Don't bring a bunch of weed, don't drink too much, and in general, don't get all messed up." Rob was going to the governor's mansion, and Oswaldo felt that he needed to treat the experience with respect. Rob was representing their kind of people, and if he got stupid, he would only be reinforcing stereotypes. In the wake of his breakdown, Oswaldo had become hyper-attuned to the way he and people like him were perceived. For his first 3 years at Yale, he'd been frustrated by these perceptions, feeling that they were inescapable, allowing that caged feeling to overwhelm him. The perspective granted him by 2 weeks of near-total isolation had led him to believe that he, and in a much bigger way, Rob, had only propagated the ignorance of their peers. Because they did get stoned all the time, they did get angry, they did dress like thugs, they did talk shit about a college education that might set them up for fulfilling lives, they did set themselves apart. For Oswaldo, the issue had ceased to be a philosophical and historical one, and instead had come to revolve around a simple goal: to graduate from Yale without making that task harder than it needed to be. After all, that was the point of college. Not freedom, not alcohol, not relationships, but to obtain a degree. After sitting in FDR's wheelchair that was on display in the museum sector of the governor's mansion, Rob ended up doing all three of the things that Oswaldo had warned him against. And Saturday night of the retreat found him passed out on the pool table, an empty bottle of the governor's whiskey clutched in his hand. With that, his initiation into the secret society, perhaps the most rarefied and exclusive component of Yale, was complete. My head was wedged between the tubular metal arm of our futon frame and the windowsill of a second-floor stair landing. "Pull," I grunted. "Don't push. Ow!" "Sorry, my bad," Rob laughed, and then the pressure eased off my skull. We were moving into the dorm again. Early September of senior year. For what would be the last time, we were rummaging through the basement storage rooms for our scuffed and dented furniture, hauling each item up the shoulder-width basement stairs, and then angling it around the landings, smashing our fingers and torquing our elbows and laughing throughout. We were in the grip of a too-conscious awareness that everything was suddenly a last. The last New Haven fall with leaves all afire, the last co-ed intramural football games, the last tailgates, the last naked parties, one Yale staple in which Rob did not take part, the last time we would all be catching up on our summers, which at this point many had spent in internships related to their chosen career paths. Beginning with the transport of furniture, we began to embrace these bright college years with an energy that hadn't existed before the light at the end of the tunnel began flashing so closely, beckoning us, while at the same time warning us to turn back. We'd been back in school for a little over a week when the Twin Towers fell. I was buying toothpaste at a CVS up Wally Avenue when I heard the urgent newscast over the radio behind the cashier, not totally following what was happening. A half hour later, in the dining hall for lunch, some students were crying. Others were shaking their heads, bewildered. Still others were already intellectualizing the event. Another 15 minutes passed before someone actually told me that the World Trade Center had been reduced to rubble, and the Pentagon had also been hit. The master walked solemnly from table to table, asking students if their families were all safe. My two older siblings lived in Manhattan now, and my parents happened to be in the city while my dad attended a surgical conference. Phones were down, but I was able to email my brother in his Soho office, where his window had given him a clear view of the bodies plummeting from the upper floors. Between the first and second towers falling, my dad had volunteered to board a bus filled with doctors from the conference, heading toward the site to set up a triage center. We didn't learn until the evening that the bus had been rerouted to Chelsea Piers, but that very few patients came in due to the severe nature of the event. The majority of affected people were either psychologically traumatized but physically unharmed or else dead. There wasn't much in between. Ty, Rob, and I gathered in our half-assembled room to watch the news, the endless replay of the second building turning to smoke. Ty kept talking animatedly about the goddamn terrorists, how we should kill them all. At one point, a plane flew low overhead, its engine reverberating through the dorm, and Ty's girlfriend screamed mortally and tried to climb under the futon. Rob sat forward, elbows on knees and hands clasped between them. He said very little that I can remember. Then he stood, and we went together to the candlelight vigil held in front of the library, during which the president of the Arab Society gave a powerful speech. Afterward, Rob went off alone. I assumed to the weed shack or Oswaldo's or somewhere comfortable for him to speak his mind about the day's events, or maybe just to study, which was what I did. He went to Anwar Reed's house. Anwar was a townie. He'd grown up in New Haven and now lived with two pit bulls 3 miles east on State Street, one of those downtrodden regions of New Haven that students avoided. Anwar hustled. That was how he and Rob had met. He was also quiet and kind, low-key, and never made fun of Rob's association with Yale, whose ornate structures had always towered in distant but clear view, seeming to mark the capital of a foreign country. Anwar was planning to join the army, and Rob went there to talk about the day's heavy consequences on Anwar's future. Unbeknownst to me, from the beginning of freshman year, Rob and Oswaldo had been drawn away from Yale via their friends on the dining hall and custodial staffs, outward into the city of New Haven. Rob considered these excursions a much-needed dose of reality, the social equivalent of an antidepressant. Anwar's yard had a view of East Rock, particularly striking at sunset when the last rays enriched the limestone frontage. He hosted a lot of barbecues in that yard, where the grill was sandwiched between a stack of cracked flat tires and a rusty wheelless wheelbarrow. Inside the small house, a threadbare beige couch and a mattress in the bedroom were the only furnishings. Ash stains branded the hardwood floor. The pit bulls curled up together in their cage in the corner. Anwar had steered some business Rob's way over the years, making movements, he called it, like Skeet and Carl had, and whenever he did so, Rob had slipped him 20% of what he'd made. Kickback, Rob would say. The look and feel of places like Anwar's, the cadence of the language spoken, the familiar topics of conversation, these elements combined to make Rob and Oswaldo feel like they hadn't, in fact, forsaken their roots. Jacinta and their dining hall chats constantly warned him to be careful. You can say things to kids here and it doesn't matter. They won't mess with you. With that boy Anwar and all them, you have to watch what you say. Protect yourself. It's not the same. Always, Rob would reply, eating at his usual spot behind her card swiping station. After 9/11, Rob could no longer carry a backpack of marijuana through the upgraded security of Penn Station and Grand Central. He bought a car, a low-riding, decades-old, two-door Toyota on its last legs. I couldn't imagine the vehicle having cost more than a few $100s. He felt that the engine had just enough juice left to get him down to Newark and back a few times, sufficient to see him through the year. Whenever he had trouble with it, which was often, he took the car to Flowey. In the years since high school, Flowey had fashioned himself into an expert diagnostician of car engines. Though the subject came up weightily in most of our classes, the real-world consequences of the World Trade Center remained largely unknown to us, as in retrospect they did to the highest levels of government. But the tragedy brought forward, with an unusual gravity, the transition we were on the verge of making. What had happened in the real world. The attack had immediately savagely altered the lives of real people, people who went to work every day, owned houses, had families, and geared their lives around something other than expanding their minds to actualize their best selves, as Yale President Richard Levin had advised us to do at our convocation ceremony 3 years before. Not every Yale student came from a sheltered background, but we were all undeniably sheltered here. No matter how important an English paper, or a math exam, or a football game felt, the realization emerged that none of these activities with which we filled our schedules truly mattered. That soon we would leave this place with whatever GPA and other achievements we had managed to obtain, and reality awaited. Gone from our lives would be the snowball fights on quads, the food prepared daily for us, the keg stands at Sigma Alpha Epsilon, and course loads designed such that there would be no classes before noon. Very soon our decisions would have consequences. Our lives would include danger. We would experience sadness and loss and disappointment on a scale heretofore unknown. With the weight and moment of 9/11 still coursing through the culture, we felt unprepared. We hid these fears the most effective way we knew how, by returning to the idiotic behavior that had marked our first weeks on campus. Rob was not above taking part. His stoner circle widened and gathered more frequently, sometimes lasting clear through a weeknight during which no studying was done. The car gave him more flexibility to go to Anwar's house, and sometimes on a whim to Mohegan Sun, an Indian casino an hour north. I tagged along once and sat rigidly in the passenger seat as he drove that beater car through the densely wooded freeways of central Connecticut, pushing 70. Outcast blaring. I'd never been to a casino, and after he gave me a 2-minute tutorial on how to play craps and blackjack, I proceeded to lose $80 with alacrity and ease, at which point I removed myself from the table to observe. Rob called me a bitch, as he'd called me many times before with affection, and I was perfectly content to spend most of the night watching him play hand after hand to blackjack and sink himself deep. His low-hanging smile belied the studiousness with which he played, contemplative about every one of his hits and splits, and more so with each $15 hand he lost. He kept throwing money on the table, always with a smile and a loose flick of the wrist. But the fingers of his left hand danced along his chips incessantly. I knew he was keeping track of every dollar in the ledger in his head. He maintained an easy dialogue with the dealer. "You had to go and give yourself an 8," he said, slapping his palm on the table after a 21 on the dealer's side. "Didn't you? Didn't you? Now why you gotta do me like that?" She was a middle-aged Asian woman, accustomed to indulging the clientele in a professional way that preserved the invisible rampart between them. Over the course of her shift at his table, Rob drew her in to the point where that barrier dissolved, and she was clearly rooting for him, almost ashamed when she drew a blackjack, beaming when Rob doubled down and won. Whenever the dealers changed, Rob gave the departing a warm goodbye and immediately began charming the next. We left campus around 11. I'd opted out of gambling by 1. Then 3, 4, 5 in the morning passed us by, and Rob played on, chain-smoking cigarettes, drinking rum and cokes. I nursed white Russians and took a few walks around to people watch and try the slot machines. An isolated casino in the middle of a weeknight had a weight to it, a desperation beneath the pale lights and chirpy dings of the machines. The few people there seemed to have come down from Boston or up from New York City, and they appeared to have little more to hope for in life than a decent winning streak. Upon returning to the table, my own hope being that Rob might want to leave soon, I paused to watch him from a distance of maybe 20 yards. He looked very much woven into these surreal surroundings. The friend whom I'd come to view as a kind of icon, who for 3 years had never once given in to the real and manufactured anxieties coursing through the rest of us, now just sat there, alone, focused only on the hand in play, seized by the hope that the hand would be good enough. During fleeting moments, between haughty exchanges with the dealer and the table slapping and chip gathering, he would look serious and worn. We left at 6 in the morning, just in time to beat commuter traffic into New Haven. We drove mostly in silence, with Shaggy singing "It Wasn't Me" on the worn-out speakers. Both of us in that woozy yet strangely sober state of having spent an entire night awake and active. I smoked with him for the first time that semester, not long after that excursion. He'd offered many times over the years, and I'd demurred offhand, until these exchanges had become a kind of rehearsed joke. Then one evening during November of senior year, he was rolling a joint. As typically began our back and forth, he raised it toward me and said with that grin, "Come on, Jeffrey, it'll chill you out," to which I was expected to say something like, "I'm cool," or "No thanks, man." "Okay, sure," I replied. He blinked his eyes and hollered, "What the fuck?" "Sure, I'll try." Rob called to Ty, who ran into the common room. They made an event out of what followed, giving me the rite of passage that Rob had never experienced as a kid taking his first toke. The only problem was that I had never smoked anything before and didn't know how. My first attempt left my mouth tasting like ash but didn't reach my lungs. "Nasty," I rasped through the dissociative tingle in the back of my throat. "What about a bong?" Ty suggested. "A bong would just about kill the kid," Rob replied, and then to me, "Come here." He made me sit on a stool directly across from him. He put the joint in his mouth and directed me to place my face in front of his, maybe 4 inches apart. "Now, just breathe in and don't stop," he said. I complied, and as I did so, he pulled fast and deep off the joint, and in a gentle, steady exhalation, streamed the smoke back over my face. The trick was called shotgunning, and it was effective. Immediately, my lungs filled to capacity with Rob's breath laced with THC. "Now hold it in," Rob said. "Hold it a minute." My track-trained and untainted respiratory system was quite powerful, and I was happy to impress him. I was also instantaneously stoned. I'd expected to feel something like the peace Rob himself exhibited when high. Instead, I just became dizzy and began giggling at every sound I heard, while a low-level paranoia fixed itself to the rear of my brain. A grin locked itself onto my face so tight that my cheeks ached for days. I was passed out not more than 30 minutes later. The next morning, while I dug at my dried-out eyes, Rob slapped me on the back and said, "You were funny as hell last night." "Do I owe you any money?" I asked. "For like 2 half hits?" he laughed. "Nah, it's on the house." His tone implied that this would be the last freebie. "I guess I thought it would be more mellow or something," I replied. "It's like you're running. You just got a train and you'll get there." My running, which had consumed every afternoon and the bulk of my weekends throughout college, had gotten me little more than a recurring hamstring pull that had long since nullified all my lofty hopes for record setting. The injury had also made me something of a basket case, logging each nutrient that went into my body, obsessing about sleep, living in terror of speed endurance practices, and overthinking races to the point where my muscles would tighten, and the bad hamstring would twinge, and my mind, rather than focus on the rather simple task of running forward as fast as possible, would collapse into uncertainty as my opponents ran on ahead. These stresses accounted for probably half of my waking thoughts for 3 years of my life, so though my first pot experience was more or less pathetic and I wasn't impelled to retry any time soon, loosening up a bit felt like a positive thing to do. More positive still was the experience of sharing this small, vital aspect of my friend's life. After a time, we all seemed to calm down and focus once again, particularly the pre-med students staring down the barrel of the MCAT. In many ways, this test was the culmination of all the studying, lab work, and anxiety that had accompanied their chosen career path. 5 hours that would decide what caliber of medical schools would consider them. These students disappeared for days at a time to study, take Kaplan courses and practice tests, and seek out any datum of information that might give them an advantage over the thousands of future doctors with whom they would be competing that day. These students resembled parents of infant triplets, bleary-eyed, beaten down, weakly managing to put a positive spin on the undertaking. Ty would score 44 out of a possible 45, placing him in the 100th percentile nationally. Even the science majors who were not planning on medical school tended to take the exam in order to at least retain the option, but Rob did not. When asked about what he wanted to do with his degree, he would change the subject to Rio. He didn't plan this trip so much as dream of it. He seemed to believe he could simply board a plane, bank over the ocean, and land among those hills, then wing it from there. I wondered about his seeming lack of post-Yale motivation, and yet his chillness aligned so naturally with who he was that I never questioned it, and certainly not aloud to him. "Rob will figure it out," those of us who knew him would say to each other. "He always does." None of us, not even Oswaldo Gutierrez, knew then what we know now, that he had netted just over $100,000 selling marijuana at Yale. A small portion of this he'd already given to his mother in installments, akin to the money he'd once left on the counter, small enough that she didn't question him when he told her it came from the dining hall job he'd quit long before. He'd spent $10,000 or so on school supplies and summer travel. He set aside another $30,000 also for his mother that he could give to her when he had a real job and wouldn't have to bend believability to explain where it came from. The remaining half, 50 large in Rob's parlance, was to pay for Rio and float him through the next year, at which point he was confident that he would in fact figure it out. I'm still not sure why, but my entire academic curriculum senior year revolved around the literary search for the father motif. In a prestigious class taught by the literature scholar Harold Bloom, I wrote my final paper on Odysseus and Telemachus, arguing that while the son searched for the father was really searching for himself. Professor Bloom gave the paper a C-minus with a single comment scrawled on page one. "This isn't Homer, it's Hobbes." My senior thesis on James Joyce's Ulysses triangulated Stephen Dedalus, his biological father, Simon Dedalus, and his surrogate father, Leopold Bloom, in an attempt to parse through the symbolic importance of blood. My final project in the creative writing tie-in to my English major was a novel, written quickly and quite poorly, about a carpenter in northern New England who, in the wake of his son's death, sets off to locate the father who abandoned him, encountering thinly veiled characters plucked from the Odyssey along the way. None of these projects was original, in the slightest, and indeed the subjects had been explored more deftly by innumerable writers before me, meaning my work was entirely derivative. Combined, they probably totaled 150,000 words, and on these words I worked hours each night, usually with Homer or Joyce, or both, open beside me.
"How do you just sit there and write shit?" Rob asked.
A popular new Nelly CD was playing. Rob's musical tastes seemed to have softened over time, and in the room I'd been hearing fewer freestyle-based, full-throttle gangster rappers like Ludacris and more melodic, overproduced songs like the one we were hearing now, "Ride With Me." "I don't know," I replied. "I just like words and kind of figuring them out." Rob knew that I aspired to be a novelist, and without having read any of the lousy short fiction I'd produced over the years, and without telling me as much, he had confidence that I'd be able to do it. Certainly more confidence than any jowly, prattling English professor or jaded over competitive creative writing student. The ugliness of the creative writing track evidenced itself in everything from the sample stories you had to submit for entry into the most notable authors' classes, to the way every one of those professors smugly advised us during the first class to choose a different career, and the shared understanding that if you could not speak fluidly at length about Raymond Carver's canon, then you would never succeed. On a fellowship application under a career plan entry I'd written, "Write books of a mythical nature." The selection committee had practically laughed me out of the room. Rob's confidence was communicated with a simple look that said, "If you want to, and you don't, then that's on you." "How the hell can you memorize every fact in every textbook?" I asked him in reply. "Not about memorization," he said and looked up thoughtfully. "It's like you look at that stereo or a clock or whatever, and you would want to write a paragraph describing it. Me, I look at things and want to figure it out, like take it apart, see what's inside it, know how it works, learn the science behind it."
"You're like that with people, too," I said.
"What do you mean?" "You're really curious about people's stories, like you're always trying to figure everyone out."
"I suppose," he replied.
Later, in the same conversation, he asked me why I was so obsessed with the Odyssey. He'd read it in high school and knew the story and themes, but he'd found the text stiff and inaccessible. "Just all the father-son stuff," I replied. "I think about that all the time."
"How come?"
"I guess it comes from stuff with my own dad.
He seems like a real cool pop."
While struggling to find a way to explain the grievances I had over my father, unfounded, self-gratifying grievances to be sure, being as my father was steady, generous, and devoted to his children almost beyond reason, I remembered where Rob's own father was, Skeet was mentioned so rarely in our room, maybe 3 times over 4 years, that forgetting was easy, and remembering made my search for words all the more treacherous. He just doesn't show or say much about how he feels. He's kind of internalized, and I care more about what he thinks of me than pretty much anyone else. So, you know, it's something that's on my mind a lot.
Yeah, I see that, he said, situating his textbook in his lap and pointing his face toward it again.
You think about that stuff? I said. With your dad? I mean, I know it's a lot different, but...
Immediately, I regretted these words.
I guess, he replied. I don't really know the man, so it's different. Mostly, I think about my
The conversation tapered off.
Spring term brought with it a flighty, giddy feeling. Final exams still had to be dealt with, but we were here. We had made it. Now, all those lasts were truly occurring. Last snowfall. Last P is for the P in Pearson College chance. Last spring fling concert on old campus. Ty and I realized that although Rob usually came to our home track meets, we had never seen him play water polo. He had been voted captain by his teammates both junior and senior years, a rarity on any sports team. But our knowledge of his sport remained limited to the team photo we found laying haphazardly on the coffee table one afternoon. In the picture, he stood left of center with his chest puffed out in a line of otherwise pale bodies, his face set to convey toughness. We drove to a tournament at Middlebury College one early Sunday morning, both of us hungover from the previous night. We wandered around the pretty campus until someone was able to direct us toward the pool. We joked about the skimpy swimsuits and rubber helmets for a minute, then half slept through a game before Yale played. Seeing Rob in the water brought us out of this stupor. We were so used to seeing him being subdued and removed, so used to him being stoned, in fact, that to see the energy he possessed in the pool reminded me of a predatory animal, like his python, Dio, once a mouse was dropped into the tank. Our eyes were locked on him, waiting to see what he would do. He did not possess the languid, long-limbed aquatic grace of Olympic swimmers. His strokes were short, choppy, inefficient, but he moved, and when he took the ball, he placed it bobbing in the water between his arms, controlling it with his chest and head as he swam the length of the pool. When preparing for a shot, his kicking legs held half his torso out of the water, the ball cradled in his palm still higher above his head and making rapid half-rotations back and forth as he sought the right angle. We could hear the smack talk 10 rows up in the bleachers. "Nah, nah, you ain't got shit," when he was defending a ball holder. "Here comes, bitch," when he was keen to score. He released these gems in a low yet resounding hiss, his teeth bared, his grin scary. That he was the only black player, from what we could tell, in the whole 18 tournament only heightened the thrashing quality of every movement he made, every word he used to intimidate. He played with his elbows bent and often deployed toward a forehead or jaw. When he was whistled for a foul, which was often, he'd raise his arms out of the water in mystification like a petulant NBA player. From above, Ty and I egged him on, fully absorbed in his joy, which was total. Less joyful was the bio Rob gave to Elihu a few weeks before graduation. The bio was the fundamental element of the secret society tradition. In any medium you choose and over any length of time you needed, you gave your life story to the 11 classmates with whom you'd been spending 2 nights a week throughout senior year. You were supposed to dig deep and challenge yourself, as well as place complete trust in the listeners to keep everything confidential. The Elihu class of 02 had been atypically diverse in a socioeconomic sense, with a disproportionate number of minority kids who'd come to Yale from poverty. Giving a bio could be stressful. One felt an inherent pressure to tell a story, and in order to do so, construct conflict, which was harder for some than for others. When during the winter a girl had gone on at length about the social stresses of the Dalton School, an expensive prep school on which the TV show Gossip Girl was based, a poor student from Chicago had begun to seethe to the point of interrupting her and pointing out that these were not problems, not real ones anyway. The girl had become defensive. This was her bio, and an important safety net in giving it was the understanding that judgments would be suspended. But still, a kind of class warfare erupted as the group split into sides. The poor kids aligned in taking offense at having to sit through 5 hours worth of rich people problems,
and the well-off kids maintaining that problems were relative and the girl should be permitted and encouraged to share the issues that weighed on her. Rob stayed out of the fray, as he stayed out of most of the conflicts that had occurred in the Elihu house. But on that night, he came to be regarded as the final authority on the matter, since his circumstances growing up had been the most real of any. "Just let her talk," he said, sipping his brandy as if for dramatic effect. And then to the kids who'd been hassling her, "Damn, it's like you people can't just listen without trying to start shit." "You people? You heard what I said. You're acting like you're all the same, so that's how I'll address you." "That's fucked up, Rob." "And it's fucked up the way you're treating her, like she's not an individual either." Then to the girl, "Proceed." As Rob's bio approached, the Elihu house filled with genuine curiosity. He'd always been content to drink the free booze and smoke up the house, but reluctant to engage in any of the meaningful personal debate that the secret society was intended to prompt. They figured he would keep it short and focus mainly on his mother. He might touch on racism at Yale or something controversial like that, just to see how everyone would react. They did not expect that he would talk for 4 full hours about a part of him they'd previously heard nothing of, his father. Seated at the head of a long oak table, speaking with no notes or pictures, he told them about his mother's unique filial strategy. The nights spent doing homework, the days spent wandering around the neighborhood. He told them about the fire on Pearson Street, the apartment on Chestnut, the wide orbit of men his father maintained. He told them about the trial, the prison visits, the successful appeal and its reversal. He told them about the letters he continued to send to various appellate judges every month. He painted the broad picture of a great man egregiously wronged by a system engineered against people like him, and he walked the Elihu Society through the day of August 8, 1987, as if he'd been an omniscient observer over everyone involved. The Moore sisters, the police, and the prosecutors. He spent a lot of time focusing on the murder weapon and how his father owned it because you had to carry a piece if you were about that life. But the real murderer had broken into his father's apartment in 2E, stolen his weapon, used it to murder the Moore sisters in 2D, and then returned it to 2E. The police had then illegally removed the gun from the scene to plant on his father so that the case could be closed quickly and spare them the trouble of having to actually do their jobs. For the entire year, Rob had placed himself above petty class conflicts that had plagued many of their discussions. On that night, he made clear to his secret society that the fundamental conflict of his life was founded on precisely that belief. The white establishment would always keep the common black man down in order to cover their own asses. Arthur Turpin had become close to Rob that year, an affluent student with an aristocratic way about him. He and Rob had passed many Thursday nights playing pool and having fun with their contrasting personas. In other words, they fucked with each other. Arthur had always been troubled by the anger he sensed in Rob, though he hid that anger well behind the grin and the laughter and the marijuana. Arthur felt it in the jokes Rob made to Laurel and others about their privileged upbringings, in his heavy quietude whenever socioeconomic topics came up in conversation, and in his general disdain of Yale and Yaleys. Arthur saw a closed-mindedness that was, he felt, self-propagating and innately limiting. More broadly, he believed these qualities explained precisely how an intelligent guy like Rob would always make life harder on himself than it needed to be. Here he was, drinking brandy in a prestigious society, in a top-ranked school, the beneficiary of so many gifts, both natural and bestowed, surrounded by bright and open-minded classmates, and yet still he remained mired in, even paralyzed by, what was effectively his own racism. Of course, Arthur never broached the subject with Rob, since it was easier to screw around instead. He'd made assumptions about his friend that were treacherous to air out, the central one being the most common. You truly can't shed your roots. On the night of Rob's bio, Arthur realized that those roots were embedded far deeper than he ever could have imagined. He felt very sad for his friend that night, listening to Rob arduously construct his own defense of his father, the defense he believed Skeet was deprived of 15 years ago, a defense that came with its own many loose ends. Rob was able to intellectualize almost every argument that arose, but where Skeet Douglas was concerned, each word of the thousands Rob spoke came from a deeply, dangerously emotional place. In truth, even after all the hours he'd spent in Trenton State talking to Skeet about it,
Rob seemed to have no idea where his father was or what he was doing on that morning. Arthur found it quite obvious that until Rob was able to place his father that day, long ago, he'd have a hell of a time trying to place himself here, now. I'd been confused by Rob's vague plan following graduation, and why it seemed to center on a 22-year-old Yale graduate living with his mother in a poor neighborhood. Then I visited him in East Orange that spring during the reading week that preceded final exams. I was en route to Manhattan to visit my brother, and the side trip to East Orange was a statement of sorts. I'd realized that though I'd offered dozens of times to take him out to dinner with my visiting family or even take him home with me for a weekend, never once had I proposed doing something where he came from. I didn't tell my parents about the visit. I could just hear my mom saying, "Be careful." Rob picked me up at the train station and acted as a tour guide. He drove me past St. Benedict's Prep, Branch Brook Park, School Stadium, and ultimately to a cookout at his Aunt Debbie's apartment. What was unnerving about Newark as we moved west and the hospitals and colleges and greens of downtown gave way to graffiti, grit, and loiterers was how cemented the poverty seemed to be, unfolding in all directions, like the ocean going on, never ending. Despite the progressive motivations that had prompted the visit, I did feel tense as it became apparent that I might be the only white person within 3 miles. And yet, with Rob at the wheel, waving to people in the street, and attaching childhood stories to practically every corner, the neighborhood didn't feel like a slum. Its streets were dirty, run down, very poor, and very black. But they didn't feel threatening, not sitting next to Rob. As we crossed into East Orange proper, I was attuned to the way he leaned back in the driver's seat, one arm slung out the window, scully knotted tightly, bass thumping. He was at ease. The reception he received at the cookout, at least 3 dozen people packed into a small yard behind an apartment complex on Hamilton Avenue, was warm in a way I'd never experienced in my own WASP upbringing, where handshakes were followed by vague descriptions of what's new, then dinner. Carl was there, as was Dante and Rob's cousins Nathan and Deandra and Corey. Rob was the mayor of this potluck gathering, but he deflected any awe directed toward him. His grandmother, Frances, was in a wheelchair with tubes in her nostrils. Her emphysema had been worsening throughout Rob's college years. Horace, beside her, looked very old and sullen behind a fixed smile. We stood by her wheelchair most of the afternoon as Rob asked everyone what was going on in the neighborhood, what was going on in their lives, offering small bits of advice to those having trouble at home or at work. One of his cousins mentioned that she was about to be kicked out of her apartment because she was $600 behind on rent. Rob took her aside out of everyone's earshot and told her he would take care of it. "I got you," he said. "Now give me a hug." What struck me in particular was the amazement on display that not only was he graduating from Yale, but he was going to do so in 4 years. 4 years, people kept exhaling disbelievingly, as if the typical time span for achieving a bachelor's degree was unfathomable. My man graduating Yale in 4 years. Jackie was the only one present who didn't seem ecstatic about Rob's pending accomplishment. She sat in a lawn chair in the back of the yard, chain-smoking menthols. She looked much older than I remembered her on orientation day, the last time I'd seen her, more gray and with a harder jaw, and she was still hard to impress. Not by the effort I'd taken to come here, not by the effort Rob had taken to make it through Yale. Looking back now, it is easy to feel as if she alone knew that success and happiness in life were more elusive even than an Ivy League diploma. Night had fallen by the time he took me back to the train station. He asked if I wanted to stop for something to eat in the Ironbound at a Portuguese restaurant he loved. He told me how seedy Ferry Street had been not too long ago, and how its revival into a busy stretch of green and red restaurant awnings was miraculous. He used that word, miraculous, a word I'd never heard come out of his mouth before. I said I had to get to the city to meet my brother, and I knew that Rob was heading back to East Orange to see his boys. I also knew that he had to attend to the matter of re-upping his marijuana supply for graduation, which was going to be a boon for business. We slapped hands, and I watched him aggressively pull his beater car into the traffic snarl that was Raymond Boulevard. Through the window, riding low, he looked serious all of a sudden, very grown up. Nobody looked grown up on graduation day. Much like orientation 3.5 years earlier, The weekend was an endless succession of ceremonies and speeches, the lawns newly seeded for the trampling pleasures of graduates and their families, most of us in some level of drunkenness at all times. To begin, elected class representatives planted a symbolic ivy vine outside one of the classroom buildings, while a sentimental, student-written poem titled Ivy Ode was read aloud. On class day, the first of the two-day-long proceedings, we were each supposed to wear a hat that said something about ourselves. I sat next to Rob during the ceremony, and in front of us arose a 3-foot replica of the Eiffel Tower from the head of a young woman, presumably of French extraction. Engineering students sported battery-powered alcohol distribution machines they'd designed. Rob, as ever, wore his Scully over his cornrows. As the class day speaker, Governor George Pataki, on whose pool table Rob had passed out a year ago, took the stage before the 1,200 giddy graduates and cracked his first weak joke of the afternoon. Rob hunched over to pack his white clay pipe with a pinch of marijuana and toke. These pipes had been given to us by the school and were supposed to break them underfoot at some point, symbolizing something. Some kids around us laughed and asked for a hit. Others scowled and said, "That's so disrespectful," in hissy whispers. Governor Pataki spoke gravely about 9/11, pleading that we not fall victim to ignorant intolerance. "Why did it take the worst act of terrorism to unite our country?" he asked rhetorically, 50 yards away. Later, our roommate Ty received the award for overall achievement out of the entire class of 02. Rob nudged my elbow and pointed to a wizard hat someone sported a few rows ahead, specked with small gold stars, like something Albus Dumbledore might wear for a Hogwarts commencement. He told me that Yale had often felt to him like the famous school for wizards, a place of Gothic spires and dark stone hallways set in another dimension, which granted access to its sorcery and secrets only to these elite few graduating with us right now. After the ceremony, Rob took Jackie to a cocktail party for parents at the Elihu house. He was excited to show Jackie the place. He'd explained what a secret society was, but the concept had always seemed to elude her. A house set aside exclusively for a dozen college students to drink booze in and share their lives twice a week, when they should have been studying. She went with him, nodded her way through the tour, exchanged polite greetings with other students and parents before her lips fell by habit into the straight horizontal line that was neither a smile nor a frown. Red wine and aged whiskey were brought around by hired servers, but she didn't drink. After the cocktails, most students dined with their families at upscale restaurants like the Chart House and Union League Cafe, or went to Maury's for the cups ritual. Gigantic chalices of boozy punches were passed around a group, and whoever finished the last drop spun the chalice upside down on his or her head, singing, "It's drinker's name, who makes the world go round." Rob took Jackie to Jacinta's small apartment a mile up Wally Avenue. I jogged through this downtrodden area often during my time at Yale because it lay between campus and the track facilities, and I'd always kept my head down and didn't stop. Jacinta lived there between Wally and Edgewood with her teenage son. A week before, Yale's black seniors had had their own graduation ceremony. This took place at the FM house, and each student asked a family member, faculty advisor, or friend to drape a scarf around his or her neck on stage. Rob and Danny Nelson had argued over who would have Jacinta bestow his scarf, and ultimately Rob had ceded her to Danny, because Danny had worked in the dining hall all 4 years of college. Rob's scarf was draped by the charismatic poet and sociology professor Derek Gilbert, whose book of poetry, Henna Man, Rob had been obsessed with amid all his science courses. Tonight, Jacinta had a braised pork shoulder on the table. The four of them sat and ate. She and Jackie talked like old girlfriends, and throughout the evening, Rob seemed tired but happy, his manner tinged with relief that these 4 years were over. But they were not over, not quite yet. We still had one more ceremony the next day, when the graduating seniors from Pearson College gathered in the college quad to receive our diplomas. We filed in from the slate patio, on which we'd first gathered almost 4 years earlier. Then Rob had been smoking a cigarette off to the side in his Timberland boots, looking older than the rest of us. He didn't look that way anymore. Maybe in our matching navy gowns and tasseled hats, anyone would be hard-pressed to look very mature. Maybe the rest of us had caught up with him somehow, though I doubted that.
Maybe we all knew him now, some very well, and so the isolationist attitude with which he'd first approached campus no longer manifested. Or maybe, most simply, he couldn't withhold a boyish smile that day. 20, maybe 25 of his friends and family had come up for the day. Aunts and uncles, cousins, neighbors, friends. They'd all packed themselves into a procession of four-seat cars and caravaned up to New Haven. In their center were Frances and Jackie. Jackie sat beside her mother's wheelchair, both of her hands stacked upon Frances's on the armrest. The dean read each of our names from a small lectern to the right of the stage, while the master gave out diplomas in the center. When she said, "Robert Deshaun Peace, Bachelor of Science in Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry, with distinction in the major," a cacophony of whoop-whoops broke out from his cheering section in the rear of the tent. Rob took his time mounting the stage. With his left hand on Rob's shoulder, the master handed the diploma over with his right, and the two men lightly hugged one another, and the hooting behind us reached a crescendo to the point where the more reserved parents and students, meaning about 90% of those present, began turning their heads, faces calibrated to amusedly share in the joyfulness, even while, in their minds, some had to be wondering why such people couldn't contain themselves a little bit more respectably. Then Rob was at the microphone on which the master had made his opening statements. He cleared his throat, a signal for his section to calm down. The heat-trapping tent grew quiet. He glanced at a scrap of paper in his hand, pocketed it, and said, "A Yale education encompasses more than classes. It is the experience that has better prepared me for life. I would like to thank all the people who supported me in this endeavor, and I dedicate this moment to my motivation and heart, my mother." I expected the audience led by the New Jersey contingent to break into cinematic applause, but for a few moments everyone remained silent and still. The clapping and cheers, when they came, were brief. Ty shouted, "Peace out," and we all laughed. Then Rob returned to his seat between us. I don't recall much of the day after that, no doubt because it revolved around more drinking, more parties. People I'd barely known or openly disliked would stumble up to me and drape a bear hug over my shoulders, slurring exclamations like, "We did it!" and "We survived!" At one point, I went back to our room, half cleared out at this point, just to take a breather. Rob was there, also alone, rolling a joint on our coffee table with that precious way he had. He offered me a hit. I shrugged, "Sure." We sat and got stoned, maybe for 15 minutes or so. We must have talked, but about what, I will never remember. Most likely we just bullshitted, without much allusion to the fact that this was it. College was over. On to the next thing, whatever that was. These moments, our last as roommates, were very calm. I woke early the next day and hungover, packed the last of my things. I knocked lightly on Rob's door to say goodbye. He wasn't there. Dio, his python, was coiled up in the glass tank atop the black trunk, still digesting a vermin eaten 5 or 6 days earlier. Textbooks were piled up in the corner to be sold back to the Yale bookstore. Two duffel bags in the center of the floor were half-packed with clothes. The pictures of the Burger Boys at 34 Smith Street and Jackie at St. Benedict's graduation had been pulled down. The incense he'd burned couldn't fully mask the smell of stale marijuana. Over the years, I'd grown fond of that smell, the vestiges of good times that had clung to curtains and carpeting, the smell of my friend. I didn't wait to say goodbye to Rob. I figured that the nature of our friendship, the nature of Rob himself, didn't necessitate that final ceremony after all the ceremonies we'd already endured. The man-hug, the firm grip, thumb-lock, hand-clench, half-hug, the not-quite-tearful later-on man. Rob was cooler and easier than that, and he wasn't going anywhere. There would always be time. I thought. Part 4. Mr. Peace. Chapter 9. He was amazed by what had been left behind. Expensive winter coats, racks filled with CDs, textbooks, halogen lamps, 600 thread count sheet sets that had never been unpackaged, gold and silver jewelry, stereos, discmans, and even laptop computers. Graduated seniors had simply departed without these things. And Rob, who was working the summer custodial job for the fourth straight year, cleaning up the campus between graduation in mid-May and the alumni reunions in early June, stayed to sweep it all up. He dealt with items of value first,
stashing anything sellable in an industrial garbage bag that he set aside. Then came the work of hauling abandoned furniture down the stairs, sweeping up all the dust and grime and hair that had accumulated over the year, mopping and painting, reconstructing bunk beds that had been pulled apart in room after room. The various spaces he'd inhabited over the years were now empty, given a clean coat of white paint, awaiting next year. We'd all come to Yale, aiming to leave a footprint. Rob knew from this work that none of us had, at least not in the dorm rooms. He took a lot of cigarette breaks alongside the full-time maintenance employees, men he'd befriended over the years. They were generally derisive of the students, the way they felt entitled to just leave their shit for others to pick up. Dozens of 50-gallon trash bags worth of said shit lay in a mountain in a corner of the quad, next to the master's house. The final task was to transport them to a dumpster on Park Street before the last debris of our time here was hauled away. They did sell the valuables they'd collected. Like every year, the 6-person custodial team combined what they'd found into one cache of contraband. First, they sold the textbooks back to the bookstore, which paid a fraction of the cover price no matter the condition. But still, it was cash. As for the rest, each member helped unload what he could. Some used the internet. Others pounded the pavement in their neighborhoods. Afterward, trusting one another's honesty, they divided the profits evenly. At the end of the 3-week stint, Rob came away with almost $1,000. The figure paled in comparison to the money he had already saved, but still, he made enough to cover the summer's rent in New Haven. He also gave himself a graduation present in the form of a second tattoo, this one on his left biceps, of an African woman with a tall headdress seen in profile. The image matched exactly Jackie's lone body art, inked during her 20s, before Rob was a thought. He remained on the custodial staff during the reunions in early June. A few thousand alumni from as recently as 5 years ago, and as far back as the 1950s, caught up beneath tented open bars and catered food spreads. The schedule included lectures and 3-course meals and various activities, like group hikes up East Rock and tours of the botanical greenhouse. But the guests, the older they were, the increasingly white and stodgy and male, mostly hung out and drank like they'd done in college. Rob moved around the fringes of the various gatherings, emptying the trash cans and picking up the plastic cups, napkins, and spilled food. Like the very first week of school, nobody looked at him and assumed he was anything other than a janitor. Unlike the first week of school, he was one. After the reunion cleanup was complete, he went back to work in the med school lab, where he assisted in researching the pharmacology of proteins that led to infectious disease, inflammation, and cancer. His primary focus was on the structural biology of chemokines, protein receptors secreted by cells to recruit an immune response to the site of an infection. Using X-ray crystallography, Rob spent the summer and fall isolating the CXCL12-SDF-1-alpha and VMIP-2-VCCL2 chemokines for the GPCR-CXCR4 co-receptor for HIV-1. This particular receptor also mediated metastasis in a number of cancers, as well as a mutation responsible for an immunosuppressive disease known as WHIM syndrome. The applications included stem cell transplantation and the production of medicines to halt the takeover of these afflictions. In our dorm room, we had always joked admiringly about the fact that Ty Canty, who was now preparing for a year-long fellowship at Cambridge, England, before undergoing a 7-year MD-PhD program at Harvard Med School, was destined to cure cancer someday. I had no idea that Rob, in the lab he'd walked to almost every day during junior and senior years, was actually helping to do it. He lived with Raquel in a basement apartment near Jacinta's that they called the Dungeon. The apartment was relatively small, especially for a man and a woman who were not romantically involved. The only windows were at the top of the wall, giving them a view of the calves and ankles of passers-by. A gigantic hammock was strung across the high ceiling in a makeshift loft for storage and, on occasion, amorous escapades. They kept their clothes in plastic containers and cardboard boxes. In lieu of paint that they didn't want to pay for, Raquel decorated with bohemian shawls and tapestries from her travels. Their home was not unlike a college dorm room, and their day-to-day lives were not unlike college in that they felt transient based on their work and social lives outside the domicile. And yet,
Within it, they found themselves playing the roles of husband and wife. Rob came home from work, and Raquel would have dinner on the table. Huge spreads of Puerto Rican fare, stewed pork or chicken sweetened with plantains and agave nectar, ladled over a bed of yellow rice. Over the meal, they would talk about their days.